This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, we explore the connection between people and animals in the developing world. In Sudan, we learn what it takes to make a living selling the ship of the desert.
We have inherited this way of life from our grandfathers in ancient times. From the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, people have been trading camels.
And helping donkeys in Ethiopia.
It's not only the mother that is going to die. Although she is pregnant, he's going to lose the foal again. He's going to lose two donkeys. Actually, it is heartbreaking, you know.
And we'll go riding on reindeer with the Aveni people of northern Siberia. That and more ahead. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In this hour, we'll be looking at how people in the developing world live with, care for, and depend on their animals. To start us off, reporter Kathy Maitani tells us about a rather unusual way camels are used in northeastern Kenya.
It's morning in Garissa, a hot, dusty town of about 150,000 near the Somali border. The Muslim call to prayer greets residents as they begin their day. Outside the town, camels and goats, adorned with wooden bells, graze in the arid bush. Illiteracy is a huge problem in this region. More than 80% of the province's 1 million people are illiterate. Garissa does have a library, but it's difficult for children living in the bush to get to it. So every 2 weeks, the library comes to the children by way of camel. In the parking lot of Garissa's library, a four-member crew is loading poles, a tarp, chairs, a table, and two wooden boxes of library books onto the backs of three camels. They are heading for Maramutu Primary School some 6 miles away. It's one of 19 schools in the region served by the mobile library. Sheikh Rashid Mohammed Farah is a librarian at the Garissa Library. He has overseen the mobile camel library since it began in 1996. Speaking in his office, Farah says, when it comes to delivering the books to outlying communities, over bad roads, camels are much more reliable than trucks.
It does not require many things. It doesn't need spare parts and these kind of things. So it's something which can be easily used.
Kenya's National Library Service pays for the camels as well as a camel herder. As the crew loads the materials onto the camels' backs, the camels grunt, groan, bark, shuffle, and generally look none too happy. The camel herder explains that these camels, all male, are particularly grumpy at the lack of female companionship. After the loading is done, the three camel caravan and library staff set off under a scorching sun, wending their way through thick bush and sandy soils. An hour and a half later, the caravan finally arrives at Maramutu Primary School. The staff quickly set up the library tarp as the camels take a break to munch on leaves in the nearby bush. The staff lay out some 200 books on straw mats just as the students begin to arrive. About three-quarters of the camel program's 7,000 books come from international donors. Most of the books are in English. Others are written in Swahili. The children are allowed to choose up to two books at a time. The subjects of the books range from mathematics to sciences to storybooks of all types. One student who seems especially glad to see them is 15-year-old Ezekiel Abiu Jeffet. He says he loves to read stories about guardian angels, animals, and distant places. Here, he reads about a subject closer to home.
Africa is the second largest continent in the world after Asia. It has area of 30.
The eighth grader says he reads books to improve his English and to teach his younger siblings some of the language as well.
I tell them to know the meaning of that word that is in the storybooks. When, for example, I saw a word like misfortune, I tell about that word, the meaning of that word.
Wayu Kofa teaches third grade at Maramutu Primary School. Since the Camel Library started making visits here, he says he has noticed a difference in the children's school performance.
The children are now able to express themselves in English. They can speak English. They can now write good essays, that is, composition writing.
The school bell here is made of a piece of metal hung from a tree. As a student rings it to signal the end of the day, the students walk home, many clutching their library books, as staff take down the tent and load up the camels. In the meantime, Omar the camel herder is rounding up his charges. After a long, hot day, they seem to be even more cranky than ever. Omar says there is nothing to worry about. Camels, like cars and trucks, are supposed to make noise. Finally, the caravan is ready to leave. The camels and staff start their long trek back to home base, their shadows lengthening in the setting sun. For the World Vision Report, I'm Kathy Maitney in Garissa, Kenya.
After that report, perhaps you're wondering where one buys a camel. If you're in Sudan, you'd head to the local market. Gretchen Wilson has our latest installment in our series on street vendors.
All along this street, women lean over kerosene grills, cooking camel meat, a staple food here. Walk around the corner, and you'll find the source of that meat. This is one of the biggest live camel markets in Africa. More than 100 camels are here today. In this corral made of barbed wire fencing, about 24 camels mill around. Their front legs are tied together to prevent them from running off, so they can only take baby steps. Mujadid Alibed Hamid is cajoling one of his camels to sit down. Hamid's been a camel trader for the majority of his 60-odd years, like his great-great-great-grandfathers before him. Dressed in the long white gown, turban, and sandals that are conventional here, he says he's proud of his herd.
The camels here are the best camels. There's no need to import others for crossbreeding.
His top camels sell for hundreds of dollars. Some will be exported as far away as Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Hamid shows off the cell phone he uses to make deals. The phone may make him a modern man, but in other ways, he sticks to a traditional way of life.
We have inherited this way of life from our grandfathers in ancient times. From the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, people have been trading camels. Today, camels are still revered for their food and milk and for transportation. That's why we refer to the camel as the ship of the desert.
Camel milk is rich in fat and protein, and everyone here drinks it fresh. Milking the camels is the job of Hamid's apprentices. For most of the year, Hamid takes his small herd on long journeys across Sudan. He rides camelback, of course, along well-worn migration routes in Darfur. Violence has ebbed and flowed there in the past 4 years. But Darfur is bigger than the state of Montana, so camel traders move through the calmer areas.
Generally, there's been peace and it's improved. But in some areas, there have been difficulties. For example, with stealing and raids on the camel herds.
Hamid says he's been lucky, but he does have to watch out for ornery male camels that sometimes get hostile and spit. For the World Vision Report, I'm Gretchen Wilson in Omdurman, Sudan.
Oh, yay!
At the start of Gretchen's story, we heard the sizzle of camel barbecue. Reporter Richard Locke got a chance to taste camel meat when he was in Somaliland recently. Let's find out if he thinks it tastes like chicken.
If a health inspector walked into the Bodali restaurant's cramped, smoke-filled kitchen, he'd have a word or two to say to the chef. The wooden work surface is covered with innards, offcuts, and slop. Flies swarm over the hunks of meat waiting to be thrown into the pot. Nonetheless, the meat that Farhan Karir is serving up is something of a delicacy here.
Yes.
Here we cook camel meat and camel only.
Camel meat is an age-old favorite among people in Somaliland. It's prized for its supposed medicinal qualities as well as its flavor. I ask Kurir which are the best cuts, thinking he'll talk about the fillet or perhaps the rump. But no, it's simpler than that.
There are three cuts considered the best. The first is from the front, the second is the middle, and then the liver. We sell the cooked liver at breakfast time, the rest at lunch. We also buy up some poorer quality cuts, which we cook up and the women sell on the streets.
In a huge vat, loin-shaped chunks simmer away over a charcoal burner. The ingredients are easy: camel, onion, tomatoes, garlic, and peppers. So too is the cooking.
First, we grill the meat over coals for 10 minutes, not more. If you grill it for longer, the meat will be ruined and no one will eat it. Then we add it to this giant pan where we simmer it over a gentle heat with the vegetables. We add a lot of water to make a soup.
A waiter barks the orders from the restaurant, and Kurir plunges an aluminium plate into the vat and scoops up a slab of meat.
Some people eat the meat on its own. Traditionally, we eat it with injera, but some eat it with spaghetti or rice.
Injera is a sour-tasting spongy flatbread made from a local crop called teff. It's used to soak up the soup, which looks a bit like dirty brown water, with a thick film of fatty globules floating on top. But the meat is surprisingly tasty. If you ask me, it's a little like mutton.
It's very soft and tender. That spice is a little bit like it's a little bit like a dal masala curry spice.
That's the chef telling me it tastes very delicious. A plate of camel will cost you several dollars, a few more cents if you want a slice of fat from the camel's gall or hump. That's not cheap by Somaliland standards, but it does have its advantages. Besides being a palatable source of protein, it doesn't come with any health warnings. In fact, it has virtually zero cholesterol. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in the Bodali restaurant, Hargeisa, Somaliland.
Let me tell you about Humphrey the camel ambling across the sands. All the nomads giving him a great big hand. He's a big ugly mammal and he's very, very hairy. All the sheiks know he's a swinging dromedary,
Up, caring for donkeys and dogs. That's ahead on the World Vision Report after this short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In this week's show, we're focusing on people and animals in the developing world. And in the next few stories, we look at veterinary care, or the lack of it. Travel on any main or back road in Ethiopia, and you're bound to see one animal in particular, the donkey. It's pulling carts, transporting water, carrying produce. The donkey is vital to the survival of most villagers and farmers there. But they're often not well cared for, and this can pose some real problems for the donkey and its owners. One Ethiopian vet is on a mission to change that. Christina Russo reports.
In the small village of Tulure, a young veterinarian is examining a very ill donkey.
Because of the back sore, she's feeling pain. And in addition, she might have a problem related with the reproductive system.
The donkey stands still as a Yele Gazaucho inspects her body. Her back sore is the result of carrying too much weight for her slight frame. Her pale brown hair is noticeably coarse, a sign of worms. Her ribs are showing. And on top of that, she's pregnant, nursing a foal, and has had two miscarriages in the past year alone. Gazaucho asked the owner if he could possibly give this donkey a rest.
He said that I have no option.
I have only these donkeys, and there is no option just to give a longer rest, he's saying. He will use all the donkeys for fetching water.
All Gazaucho can do now is explain the consequences to the farmer.
It's not only the mother that is going to die. Although she is pregnant, he's going to lose the foal again. He's going to lose two donkeys. So I will tell him the consequences. Actually, it is heartbreaking, you know.
This is a common scene for the 30-year-old vet. He works for the Donkey Health and Welfare Project based at the Addis Ababa University in central Ethiopia and runs the project's mobile veterinary clinic. He and a small team of other vets travel from village to village, providing free medical care to sometimes as many as 1,000 donkeys a day. He also educates farmers on how they can better care for this critically important animal.
In every activity of the farmer, there are donkeys. At the plowing season, in the harvesting season, if they are traveling to a market, if they are traveling to a grinding mill, every agricultural activity, there are donkeys. So farmers usually say, a farmer without donkey is donkey himself, you know?
Gazaucho instructs owners on such basics as what harness to use so donkeys won't suffer from back sores and why it's essential to give them deworming medicine. There are 5 million donkeys in Ethiopia, the most in any country in Africa. Gazaucho says it's troubling that despite the central role donkeys play in everyday life, they are often neglected.
The majority of the people, they consider that donkeys do not deserve treatment. If a donkey gets sick, it will go die soon. It doesn't deserve better management. They consider donkeys deserve beatings in spite of her vital contribution to the livelihood of the country and to the economic growth of the country.
So Gazaucho explains to villagers that caring for a donkey is a good financial investment, and that message seems to be getting through. The program has helped treat over 500,000 donkeys in the last two decades, and they're now living on average 5 years longer. Still, Ethiopian donkeys live only half as long as well-cared-for working donkeys elsewhere. So the project hopes to educate the next generation of donkey owners. It provides special classes on donkey welfare in village schools. In this third grade class, the guest instructor quizzes the students on the ideal weight a donkey should carry. Vet Ageli Gazaucho translates.
Another example. A donkey weighing 150 kg should carry how much kg?
Kilo?
50 kg. He answered correctly.
It will be a long road, Gazaucho admits, to change the way most Ethiopians view the donkey. The vet hopes that one day many more people will be as passionate about the animal as he is. After all, he says, these animals are blessed because Jesus traveled on the back of a donkey.
So a donkey deserves a better management, a better treatment, and a good perception. No.
And you want to change that?
Yeah, I want to change that.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Christina Rousseau in Tulure, Ethiopia.
This next story is about people in Nepal who want to give their farm animals medical care, but there aren't nearly enough vets around to provide it. So an American charity is training lay people to take care of most animal ailments. Reporter Peter Aronson spent a day with one of these animal health workers. He reports from the village of Chunikel, outside Kathmandu.
Basanti Lama lives here in a simple earth-colored adobe house. The 33-year-old is unmarried and looks after her mom. She also looks after hundreds of animals in the surrounding villages, though she's not a veterinarian.
I'm a village animal health worker.
That means the services of this soft-spoken young woman are always in demand.
Hello. Hajur.
She needs to go see some patients in a nearby village, including a piglet with a wound. So she sets off for a nearby village, wearing a turquoise blue pantsuit with her matching scarf slung across her shoulder. A nonprofit called Heifer Project International trained Basanti to provide medical care to farm animals. The Arkansas-based group gives away animals like pigs and goats to poor people around the world. But one condition for that is that there has to be a veterinarian within reach. That's a problem in Nepal. There are only 400 vets in the entire country, and all but 100 of them live in the capital, Kathmandu. And rural areas can take days to reach. So Heifer started its own training. Students must have a 10th grade education and attend a 35-day course taught by veterinarians in the city of Pokhara. The training includes fieldwork in nearby villages. Veterinarian Surya Bhadracharya oversees animal health for Heifer Project Nepal. She says the organization not only provides training, but basic equipment too.
Like the simple microscope, which they need for checking the fecal examinations. And also we give them the castration machine, which is very common practice that people castrate the animal. And besides that, because the village animal health workers, they are also poor. They cannot suddenly start up their business there. So we have a revolving fund, which they use for buying medicines, so they begin their business.
After a 10-minute walk, Basanti arrives at the neighboring village of Galban, where many of the animals, like this family's first two pigs, also came from Heifer. She examines the piglet with the wound and dabs it with ointment. Village animal health workers don't do surgery, but they can treat wounds and other skin problems, intestinal disorders and infections, and perform castrations. In this traditional society, Basanti Lama says it wasn't easy to get people to trust her because she was a woman. But she proved herself after a tiger attacked a goat in a nearby village.
A lady came to get me, and when I reached the village, everybody was surrounding the goat. I checked its pulse, and it was nearly dead. There were so many deep wounds. I told the family it was just about impossible to save its life, but I'd try my best. It was my first time, and my hands were trembling. I put on dressings and gave it an injection. The next day, its condition improved a little bit. After 3 or 4 days, the goat started to eat, and later it was all right. The family was so happy with me. They told other villagers about me and my work.
That was nearly 2 years ago. Now some 300 families depend on her. She actually spends most of her time educating village farmers about hygiene and practices that keep animals from getting sick in the first place. Villagers like Meera Rana really appreciate her.
Basanti's been very helpful, and whenever we call her, even if it's early in the morning or late at night, she comes right away. Most of the time we call her when a pig is giving birth to piglets. If Basanti weren't there, we'd have to call a doctor in the city, and they wouldn't come in time to help.
The local people who've received animals from Heifer Project collectively decide the maximum rates Basanti Lama can charge. Those same rates apply to non-Heifer Project participants as well. The rates are set quite low. She snips off a strip of 4 deworming pills for one woman's goat. Total cost? 40 cents. Still, some families can't even afford that much.
If they have money, they give it to me. If they don't, I don't charge anything. But sometimes they give me vegetables, butter, milk, and even crops.
Even so, she's able to make a good living. In one room of Basanti Lama's two-story mud brick house, a little glass cabinet serves as the local veterinary pharmacy for all the nearby villages.
This is piperazine, which is used for deworming. And these are injections, which I use to treat fever. I spend my own money to buy these medicines. I'm recouping my investment, and I can help my family also.
She helps a lot more than just her family. Village girls tell her they want to be like her. Farmers say they wish they had a daughter like Basanti Lama. But Basanti isn't content with the skills she has now, so she's getting additional veterinary training on her own in the Kathmandu Valley so she can treat even more animal ailments. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson near Kathmandu, Nepal. Güldüm bir kana dezem da tütün çok
жүрегім дүні башында ай нәгідім ажүгірді жоқ.
The Humane Society of the United States runs a program called RAVS. That stands for Rural Area Veterinary Services. Volunteers and staff travel around the world setting up temporary vet clinics in communities with no animal health care. They've worked everywhere from Guatemala to Guam. And they've also worked in poor communities in the U.S., including more than 40 Indian reservations. Veterinarian Eric Davis heads up RAVS. He told me how the program works on reservations.
What we do when we set up, and we set up in some, you know, community building, quite often it's a, you know, an auditorium or a basketball court or a elementary school classroom. We bring all of our equipment, and what we try to do is we try to provide a fairly broad spectrum of veterinary care. Every animal that we look at or treat gets a full medical record. They get a full physical examination. In addition, there tends to be an overpopulation of animals on these reservations. We talk to owners about the advantages of neutering animals, and so we do a number of spay and neuter surgeries. We will often see animals that have injured eyes, broken legs, various types of things that we can treat with treat surgically or medically. Then we spend time with the owners talking about how what they can do to improve the animal's welfare status.
You know, in poor communities, and I'm sure this is true on reservations, you often see these animals on the street. They look underfed and they have mange and they're not well taken care of. It would be easy for one to think that these people really don't care about their animals. Do you find that when you go into the communities, the people don't care as much as you would hope they would about their animals, or is something else going on?
Well, once again, there's a spectrum, and I don't know what it is about humans, you know. I don't think I'm being naive in saying that when we all start off as children, you know, we tend to be more caring and gentle and kind. And as people get older and more mature, perhaps they get hardened and more in tune with whatever realities are, which means that you have to worry about yourself rather than other living things. But particularly with children, they really do care about the animals. And you'll get a spectrum throughout the community. I don't really feel that, you know, as I've worked in a number of different cultures. I mean, the typical affluent Caucasian culture that most veterinarians work in, and I've worked on reservations, and I've worked in Central America, Indian subcontinent. The spectrum of people and the way they relate to animals is pretty much the same everywhere.
Do you have any anecdotes or stories you can tell us about? You mentioned children and how they care for these animals. Any stories in particular about a child with an animal your team has encountered?
One that comes back to me fairly frequently is we were working on a reservation in South Dakota, and this was a long day, and there was one young dog that we had gone ahead and done a surgery on, and it had been brought to the clinic by a child, a little girl that looked like, I don't know, she was probably maybe 10, 11 years old, something like that. It had gotten dark, and she needed to take this dog home, and it had recovered from surgery, but it needed to get home. She waited until we were all cleaned up, and then she got in the truck with me, and we drove out to the Indian housing development, and she directed me through the winding roads of this housing development. And these are government-issue houses, and there are a lot of non-functional cars laying around and garbage and so forth and broken windows and whatnot. And we finally get to this one house, and we stop out in front of the house, and I pick up the dog in a towel that we had and follow her up to the front of the house. And I go up to the door, and I was going to knock on the door, and she says, no, don't wake my dad up. Don't wake my dad up. He doesn't want this dog in the house. And I said, okay. And she said, I stay with it down here in the basement. So I followed her into the basement, and the room was just absolutely filthy, you know, and this little girl looked like she didn't get a bath very often and her, you know, didn't have socks on her shoes and so forth. And she said, just go ahead and put the dog down over here on my bed. And this bed was literally a pile of rags. I mean, they're rags that you wouldn't wash your car with. And this little puppy meant everything in the world to her, enough that she would risk, you know, being in trouble with her family to have it in the house to make sure it got better after surgery.
Those are the kinds of stories that I'm sure make your work after an 18-hour day very worthwhile.
Well, it makes it worthwhile. It also makes it frustrating. You know, I mean, we made their lives a little bit better for some period of time. It would be wonderful if you could do more.
Right. Dr. Eric Davis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Well, it's really been a pleasure.
Eric Davis is head of the Humane Society's Rural Area Veterinary Services. We spoke to him from Stanford, California. Coming up, surviving in one of the coldest places on Earth.
You could say that they have adapted to the environment by imitating the reindeer, by mimicking it, by becoming reindeer, you could say.
We learn about Northern Siberia's Iveni people and their reindeer. That's ahead after this short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. We continue with our animal theme today by heading to Thailand. The elephant was once the workhorse for the logging industry there. When the government banned logging in the 1980s, a lot of elephant trainers found themselves out of work. But a government-sponsored program is keeping both elephant and trainer employed. The World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber takes a ride on an elephant and tells us about its trainer. A man who spends more time with his elephant than he does with his family. Here's Cynthia's reporter's notebook.
I'm in northern Thailand at the government-sponsored Thai Elephant Conservation Center. I'm here to learn how to be a mahout.
Sung sung. Sung sung. Sung sung. Get on.
Get on.
Nang long.
Nang long.
Sit down. Nang long.
Nang long.
Get bon.
Traditional music plays on a loudspeaker nearby as I start working with Cow, an 8-year-old elephant who's not yet fully grown. But she's still huge, incredibly smart, and a lot stronger than I am. I grab a hold of one of Cow's ears, step on her raised knee, and hoist myself over. I wriggle into place and tuck my knees behind her ears. I'm not sure I'm cut out for this lifestyle. Sitting on top of an elephant scares me. Okay. The mahout who's training me is named Poom. He's a short, slight 22-year-old, dressed in the standard outfit of blue canvas tunic and pants. I'm decked out in the same this week. I call out a word in Thai to the elephant. Poom repeats the call. Cow sits down in response. I don't know if I'm not pronouncing the word right or if Cow only listens to her mahout. Poom's been working with Cow since he was 17 and the elephant was 3. A mahout may spend a lifetime with just one elephant, so considering their ages, this will probably be the case for Poom and Cow. I give another call, which Poom must also repeat, and I jump off before Cow lies down on her side. Cow takes a brief break to munch on some long grasses off to the side of the training ring. Poom and I take a break in the main building and talk.
If you can control a big elephant, you can control anything. It's a very good job.
Poom says he loves Cow like a baby. He greets her in the morning, bathes her, feeds her, spends the entire day with her. In fact, he spends more time with her, he says, than he does with his own six-month-old child.
Every season, if it's cold, if it's raining, you have to take the elephant to the forest. You have to clean the elephant. It can be very dirty, very hard. You have to love the elephant to do this.
As Poom says, part of elephant care involves cleaning them. Here, it happens three times a day. Mahouts and mahouts in training bathe the elephants in a bend in the nearby river. The elephants seem to love it. The mahouts certainly do. They grab the elephant trunks and direct the animals to squirt us with water. The elephants also put on a show for day tourists. They pull logs, turn on and off a tap of water, and place hats on the heads of the mahouts. And they even play musical instruments.
All right, after this, let me show you again and let me sing this song for you.
These tourist dollars support jobs for about a couple dozen mahouts, as well as elephant care. A hospital here treats elephants from around the country. Some have even been injured by landmines along the Thai-Burmese border. At the end of my few days at the Elephant Conservation Center, I can tell Cow to offer up a knee for me to hop up. I can tell her to go forward, backwards, turn to different sides. But was she listening to me or to the mahout who rarely strayed far from my side? Personally, I think Cow was just humoring me.
Cynthia Graber is a producer with the World Vision Report. Ever heard of the term nighttime spinach? No, it's not an heirloom variety of the leafy greens. Actually, it has nothing to do with vegetables. Nighttime spinach is the term used in refugee camps across Africa for meat that comes from animals that were poached. The meat is traded in secret and cooked after dark. Earlier this year, the group that monitors wildlife trade released a report on nighttime spinach. It focused on wildlife in Tanzania. Simon Millage is the director of the monitoring group in Tanzania. He says at the time, the country was home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from Burundi, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
A lot of the camps were set up very, very quickly, almost overnight. And so, you know, there wasn't the time really to do the proper planning in terms of where they would be. So as a result, a lot of them did actually end up near game reserves. So then there was a very, very big demand for meat. Most Africans in East and Central Africa, meat is a very, very core part of diet. And that's really where the pressure came from.
Aid organizations did provide the refugees with food, but not with meat. So refugees went into those nearby reserves and poached protected wildlife. They hunted antelope, buffalo, zebra, even chimpanzees. As a result, the population of these animals plummeted by between 60% and 90%.
There's just a very, very clear overlap in terms of the time period in which refugees came into Tanzania and the time period in which wildlife populations declined in these protected areas. And I don't think there's any doubt that was the primary reason.
The World Food Program says it's not economically feasible to provide refugee camps in Africa with meat. But Millage says to prevent poaching, it's crucial.
Refugees in other parts of the world have in the past been given meat as part of rations, and so I think it's also possible to do that in the context of refugee camps in Africa.
Since the 90s, the number of refugees in Tanzania has gone down.
But of course, there's always the possibility of new refugee situations appearing elsewhere on the continent, so some of the lessons learned from Tanzania are a very, very important learning process for new camps that could spring up in other countries.
That was Simon Millage. He heads up the Tanzanian office of the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network called TRAFIC. He spoke to us from Dar es Salaam. There are efforts in Tanzania that discourage poaching. One of them is Roots and Shoots, an environmental education program run by the Jane Goodall Institute. Instructors from the program go into refugee camps and teach poultry farming. Thank you. In this hour, we've heard how people eat, care for, and depend on their animals. To end today's show, we'll learn about people whose lives are intimately entwined with one animal, the reindeer. The Aveni are a traditional nomadic people who make their home in the punishing land of northern Siberia. They depend on reindeer for transportation, clothing, food, even their spirituality. British anthropologist Piers Vitebsky has spent more than two decades studying the Aveni culture. Here he reads from his book about them, The Reindeer People.
In the Verkhoyansk Mountains of northeast Siberia, Aveni nomads are on the move. Teams of reindeer pull caravans of sledges down the steep slide of a frozen mountain river. Bells tinkle on the lead reindeer, while dogs on short leashes dive closely alongside, through the snow like dolphins beside a boat. One man sits on the lead sledge of each caravan, his right foot stretched out in front of him and his left foot resting on the runner, ready to fend off hidden rocks and snagging roots. Passengers, or cargo, sit on the sledges behind. The passage of each caravan is visible from afar by a cloud of frozen reindeer breath. This is the coldest inhabited place on Earth, with winter temperatures falling to minus 96 degrees Fahrenheit. The ice is a condition of the water for 8 months of the year, and by January it is 6 feet thick. Throughout the winter, warm springs continue to break through the surface of rivers, where they erupt as frozen turquoise upwellings, like igneous intrusions in rock, and freeze into jagged obstructions. Caravan after caravan jolts over the last ridge of river ice and skims across a great frozen lake in an epic sweep stretching almost from shore to shore. Deep lakes provide a more level surface, and the ice that forms from their still water glows black, marbled with milky white veins snaking into the depths. The sudden speed and the spray of ice crystals flung into our faces, behind the hypnotic flash of the reindeer's skidding hooves, make it easy to feel that we are about to take off and fly into the air.
That's Piers Vitebsky reading an excerpt from his book, The Reindeer People. He's a British anthropologist who spent more than two decades following the Aveni people, a traditional nomadic people in northern Siberia. Their lives are intimately entwined with one animal, the reindeer. Piers Vitebsky, welcome to the World Vision Report.
Thank you.
Let's start off with the Aveni people. How long have they actually lived in Siberia?
They probably migrated 2,000 or 3,000 years ago from Manchuria, which is now in northeast China, and gradually moved northwards.
And they've lived always as nomads, herding reindeer. Is that right?
Herding reindeer probably began only 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Before that, they would have been hunters, and the reindeer wasn't yet domesticated. So they domesticated the reindeer in order to ride on its back and hunt wild reindeer.
You know, and you mentioned in your reading about how freezing cold it is in Siberia, and certainly that's how we all think of Siberia. You said, I think, 96 below zero. That's pretty unbelievable. How do tribes of people survive in such a cold, punishing environment?
They survive by being very skillful and having a very highly adapted culture. And their way of surviving is also entirely dependent on the reindeer, not only to ride around on it, not only for food, but because they clothe themselves in reindeer fur, which is the warmest fur you can find. You could say that they have adapted to the environment by imitating the reindeer, by mimicking it, by becoming reindeer, you could say.
Really? How do they become like reindeer?
By wearing these clothes, they not only look like reindeer in winter, they even smell like reindeer. And they are so attuned to the psychology of reindeer, you could say, that there is a lot of sympathy, a lot of empathy between humans and animals.
So you mentioned that they identify so closely with the reindeer that they even sometimes look like them. Can you describe a little for us what it was like to travel with them and live among them and watch them interact with their animals?
Yes. Well, first of all, in the 1980s, when I began going there, all the struggle was to get there because the region was politically closed. So it took some years to negotiate. And I eventually ended up living with these people. The way one lives is
In the summer, they live in small tents because they have to move every few days, because the reindeer move their grazing ground or have to be moved on to avoid overgrazing the very thin vegetation. In the winter, in the past, in the old days, they used to live in tents as well. Now some of them have built wooden huts to live in for the winter, and for those few months they don't migrate as often. But it's a way of life in which every day somebody has to go out and look after the herd of animals, move them on, guide them towards good grazing, away from dangers of wolves and bears, and so on. And this is just a total way of life.
Well, what are some of the other purposes they use the reindeer for? You've mentioned for clothing, for eating. What else do they do with the reindeer?
Transport is the most important. So in summer, when the ground is boggy, you can't sledge, and you saddle the reindeer and you ride around on their backs. And the herders themselves are amazingly skilled. They will just leap into the saddle. They'll float into the saddle like a ballet dancer. And the reindeer sets off almost before they've landed on the saddle. It's a coordinated movement between the rider and the reindeer.
It must be a beautiful sight.
Oh, it is. And when a reindeer herder is riding on a reindeer, he can go right into the middle of the herd. And they look like a centaur with antlers, if you like, because the body covered with fur and the reindeer covered with fur, it's like one creature.
Now, I take it the spiritual beliefs of the Aveni people that you studied were deeply intertwined with the life and history of the reindeer. And if that's the case, how does that work? How do the reindeer shape the spiritual beliefs of these people?
What I found was that they see wild animals and domestic animals as being very different spiritually and psychologically. So wild animals, including wild reindeer, which they hunt, are very inscrutable, very hard to understand. Now, domestic reindeer have entered a sort of social contract with humans, and there are even legends about how the first reindeer made a bargain with an early human so that the reindeer would serve the humans, and in return the humans would protect them from wolves. And the serving that the reindeer offers is, it allows us to ride on its back or to harness sledges to it. It offers itself for meat. And another thing that they believe reindeer do is each person has a consecrated reindeer of their own, a kind of personal animal double, which protects you from harm. So when some serious danger is threatening you, this personal animal double puts itself in front of you and takes the blow for you.
So it's almost as though everybody they believe they're assigned a reindeer angel of sorts.
In a way, yes, that's how we might understand it.
Things changed for the Aveni people and their reindeer herds under the Soviet regime. How did life under Soviet rule affect the Aveni people and their culture?
The Soviet regime was faced with a population who were completely nomadic and lived in small families in tents, just moving around. So what they did was they thought, nomadism is primitive, we have to civilize these people. So they built villages. And they started to centralize the population in these villages. So this really did transform the Aveni people's relationship to the world, we could say. And in particular, they invented jobs for women, like kindergarten teacher, accountant, in order to take them off the land. And the children were also brought in and put in boarding schools. And this was very similar to what happened to Native Americans. But in addition, because the women were in the villages, and the reindeer were still out on the land, that left the men on the land very isolated. And these days you have a huge number of bachelors and a huge amount of unhappiness, suicide, violence caused by this isolation and frustration of the men.
So is the next generation, the younger generation of the Aveni people, holding on to these traditions and their intimate relationship with the reindeer, do you think?
That's difficult because over the last few years, electricity has appeared in the village, videos have appeared, television. So that, of course, draws young people away from a life on the land, which they now see as not only tough, but actually primitive as well. So on the one hand, there are many young people who just don't want to go out and live with the herds anymore. On the other hand, there are some, if you're a free spirit and you regard the village as a kind of confinement and you want the freedom of moving, roaming around the mountains, then those people still go out with great enthusiasm.
Piers Vitebsky, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
That's a pleasure.
Piers Vitebsky is an anthropologist at the University of Cambridge in England. He's author of the book The Reindeer People, Living with Animals and Spirits in Siberia. To see photos of the Aveni people and their reindeer, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. You'll also see photos of some of the other people and places you've heard about today. And we have a link there so you can podcast the show and listen to it whenever you want to. Our production team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.